Last time we looked at Shaiva Siddhanta, and we looked at the tantras, formation of the tantras, and now we're looking at the non-Siddhanta, beginning non-Siddhantika traditions. So,
Two sheets of two identical ones.
Apologies to those of you listening to the tape, please have added.
Okay, last week we had remember there was the Ati Marga and the Mantra Marga. In the study of in Shaivism, and then the Mantra Marga is divided into these two sub traditions, the Shaiva Siddhanta, which still exists in South India, that's normative Shaivism. It has these three realities of Shiva, the soul, and the world. And then what used to be called Kashmir Shaivism, but it's... And that's a too restrictive term, so we... They're called non-Siddhantika traditions now. I.e. the traditions which are not the Siddhanta. So we looked at that last week, and now we're going to look at the non-Siddhantika traditions today. Now, these were founded on groups of texts called tantras, which were regarded as an alternative revelation to the Veda in the medieval period, in the early medieval period. It's very difficult to date texts, as you know, in India. We got quite old manuscripts of some of the tantras from Nepal, going back to about the 11th century, I think. Quite old. But probably these texts are about 6th, 7th century, the earliest ones. And the different groups of tantras, and some groups are devoted to different deities. And there's one group of tantras called the Bhairava tantras, which are devoted to Bhairava. Bhairava is a ferocious form of Shiva. And he was worshipped by these groups that I mentioned last week called the Karpalikas, these ascetics who lived in cremation grounds, who carried a skull, and they're the forerunners of the Aghoris, the present-day Aghoris in India. And there was a tradition of ascetics living in cremation grounds. It's well attested in the text. It seems to go back quite a long way. The Pali Canon of Buddhism, there's very interesting passages in there about cremation grounds, ascetics. Monks living in cremation grounds, Buddhist monks living in cremation grounds. And traditions were concerned with the propitiation of ferocious deities through offering impure substances, namely blood, meat, alcohol, and caste-free sexual substances to these ferocious deities, making these offerings to them. Who knows how old this tradition is, but it's probably the early medieval period. It's at least as old as that. But
so Bhairava is supposed to be the god of death also, so you propitiate him when somebody is sick in the family with liquor?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But if you're a Brahmin, you probably wouldn't, would you?
I do.
Oh, you do? Oh, you're with alcohol. Ah, right, some Brahmins wouldn't do that.
But then this is not a clear-cut demarcation, because when my father was dying, we were asked to do it by the pundits and we did it.
Right.
So there is not a clear-cut demarcation that a Brahmin wouldn't do it. Really.
Right.
Bhairav is actually propitiated in India for the monsoons also now.
Oh, indeed.
The Hindi belt.
Yeah. And Nepal is very big. He's propitiated there. There's a not too long ago, about 3 months ago, there was an aircraft that couldn't take off in Kathmandu, and
yeah.
something wrong with it. I don't know what's wrong with it. But anyway, they sacrificed two goats to Akash Bhairav, the Bhairava of the sky. You know.
Yeah.
So it's still a very important deity. But anyway, the cremation ground asceticism probably goes back to the time of the Buddha, and you have, well, if not earlier, so because you've got Buddhist monks there in meditating in cremation grounds, meditating on death. And there's a very interesting in the Vinaya, I can't remember the reference, where a woman called Kali actually makes an offering to one of the monks, a Buddhist monk. So it could be a very ancient tradition. And in the present day, the Agoris of Benares are inheritors of this tradition. They are ascetics who beg with a skull and generally behave in an obnoxious fashion in order to attract the good karma of others. And the Agoris have been appropriated by the middle classes of India now. It's very interesting. So you get Agori, Kela Ram is a famous Agori guru in Varanasi who attracts the adulation of the of the Benares middle classes.
This is a difficult thing. They eat the dead body, the burning dead bodies from the pyre.
Yeah,
it's a difficult thing to be an Agori. I mean, I'd rather be.
Well, indeed, one of the rituals is supposed to be a corpse eating ritual.
That's horrible. Yeah, they corpse. They eat the corpse, burning corpse.
And sitting on a corpse.
So
that's one of their, in order to.
So what literal meaning about it?
Agori, the non-terrible one. Gora is terror or fear. Gora is horror. So agora is the non. It's euphemistic. It's the non-terrible one.
Non-terrible.
Yeah. Gora. I wonder if it's related to gore. To sense to English, it could be cognate gora. I don't know. Anyway, cognate with gore. No, I don't think so. It's quite possible.
So this is gore and that is gora.
Yeah, gora.
Gora and gora. G and G.
Mm-hmm.
It's a different thing.
Oh yeah, but gora is I'm wondering if it's related to the English word.
Okay, to an English word. I thought it was an Englishman. I was like, no. I thought you were saying gora, which means white.
Gaura. No. I think there's an English word gore, which means kind of blood and horrible things.
Yeah, gore, yeah.
So I'm wondering if it's related etymologically.
And then Benares.
Mm-hmm. Benares, yeah, Varanasi.
Sorry?
Varanasi.
Varanasi.
Yeah, Varanasi. So you've got these agoras still there today. But it's. Parry is very good on this, the cremation ground traditions of Benares. Death in Benares. I wrote a book called Death in Benares. I think it's. I can't remember his first name, but Jonathan Parry. Parry. He's a standard authority on this. Now, in the medieval period, going back in time, you have these different groups. They're called Kula. Kula means family, is a primary meaning. And there are fundamentally three traditions of the non-Siddhantika ascetic systems, called the Trika, the Krama, and the Kaula. And these are all subsumed within a general category of Kula, which is worship of the goddess. And the Trika means threefold, and they worship three goddesses. The Krama means gradation, because they worshipped a hierarchy, a graded hierarchy of 12 Kalis, 12 emanations of Kali. And the Kaula was another group. Now, the edges of these systems are not clear-cut all the time, but they're differentiated by the mantras that they use. And what they're characteristic, these the Trika, the Krama, and the Kaula systems are characterized by their non-conformity to Vedic traditions. And there's some degree of conformity to the Trika. So if you've got the Vedic orthodoxy here, the Brahmanical orthodoxy concerned with purity, right at this far end you have these Kula, these Kaula traditions concerned with impurity and constructing themselves as the opposite of the Vedic tradition. So they appease ferocious deities, particularly goddesses, with blood, alcohol, sexual substances, and blood, meat, and wine. And so they court impurity. Why do they do that? They do that because they say it's the quick path to liberation and power. They're interested in power. Siddhi. And also liberation in due course. Now these are very interesting and very attractive to the kings of medieval India, these traditions, because kings want power. So they came to have, they infiltrated the mainstream courtly culture and became, the Orthodox Brahmins became very worried about these traditions, a bit like sort of new religious groups or something like that. And Bhatta Narayana, for example, wrote a play, Agamadambara, Much Ado About Scripture, as Alexis Anderson translates it, in which he lampoons these characters. But it expresses a very real concern that at the heart of the of governance of the king's court were these, what he regarded as immoral influences, rotting the heart of society, as it were. So Bhatta Narayana also wrote, he was a Nyaya, he also wrote the Nyaya Manjari, the bouquet of the flowers of logic. In prison, he was chucked in prison, we don't know why, but he wrote this great thick book there, and he's a very, very humorous man, and lots of his, in that book, he talks about these new revelations of the Tantra that are coming up all the time in the current age. And he says these revelations are okay. He doesn't have a problem with with God revealing himself in the current age. But he does have a problem with these extreme groups who were immoral and conform and courted impurity, which he thought was had a very bad effect on society generally. So he wanted the king to banish these groups.
What was his name, please? You said it twice and I didn't get it.
Bhatta Narayana, Bhatta Narayana, yeah. I'll write it in. So he's an interesting 11th century Kashmiri who's worried about these groups. And the Krama system, for example, worships different forms of Kali. And they have a very interesting cosmology. One of the things is that the universe is an emanation and contraction of consciousness, pure consciousness. That's one of the key ideological points of these systems. And there's another hymn, there's a text called the Dehasta Devata Chakra Stotra, a hymn to the circle of deities in the body, which is attributed to Abhinavagupta, but probably isn't by him. And that describes the body as inhabited by all the different deities of this system. These systems are characterized by philosophical idealism, what's called idealism, which means that there's only consciousness is the prime reality of the universe rather than matter. So they're opposed to the materialists.
So body was recited by different deity.
That's
but
right.
When does this like idea started?
Well, it's very old. I think it goes back to the Brahmanas, really. But these particular deities are unique to this system. So you have Ananda Bhairava and Ananda Bhairavi, his consort, located in the heart. And there's a lotus, you visualize a lotus, and there are different goddesses, these are yoginis, located on the different petals.
So which century you were thinking?
Hmm?
Which period, which century? The origin, like earliest.
Probably about the 9th or 10th century of this particular system.
9th or 10th.
Yeah.
And you mentioned like the earliest like prototype of this idea.
Do you get them I think the Shatapatha Brahmana contains some reference to these. Well, it's contained in the area of the Bandha, the connection between the body and the universe.
Yeah.
And I think that you get explicitly, I'd have to check though, I'm afraid, the idea of deities located in the body in those early texts, in the Vedic corpus.
In Vedic texts?
I think, yes, you'd have to check on that though.
Already
have that idea. Yeah, I think so. But these systems are idealistic. They deny the distinction between purity and impurity. If there's only pure consciousness, how can there be any distinction between purity and impurity? How can there be distinction between subject and object? And so to realize the reality of non-dual awareness, they tended to flaunt impurity, to court impurity, to eradicate any mental distinction between the pure and the impure. And particularly worship three goddesses called Para the Supreme, Parapara the Supreme, Non-Supreme, and Apara the Non-Supreme, and they're all emanations of a root goddess called Kala Sankarshini, you don't have to bother with her name really, but a form of Kali. And then they worshipped on a trident. There's each goddess is at one of the prongs of the trident, emanating out from the goddess, the base of the trident. And the root text here is a text called Malini Vijayutra. And Abhinavagupta, who is the most famous theologian of the Kashmir Shaivism, if you like, writes two texts called the Tantra Loka, the Light on Tantras, and the Tantra Sara, the Essence of the Tantras, which is an exposition of that text, the Malini Vijayutra Tantra. There's a good account of this by Somdev Vasudev called The Yoga of the Malini Vijayutra. And there's also an important book by Jürgen Haneder, Hanneder, called The Revelation, Revelation According to Abhinavagupta, which is about that. Abhinavagupta's Philosophy of Revelation. That's the precise title. And Abhinavagupta is initiated into the Trika tradition. He's also initiated into the Krama and the Kaula cults, it seems. And he's concerned with adapting these idealistic systems to the householder's way of life. So he's an Orthodox Brahmin in Kashmir. He's supported by the king, and his intellectual project is to defeat the Shaiva Siddhanta and to supplant the Shaiva Siddhanta with his own idealism. So although he assumes the ritual structure of the Shaiva Siddhanta, he says that the revelation of the tantras that he understands goes beyond the Shaiva Siddhanta. And he's trying to colonize, if you like, the Shaiva Siddhanta tradition with his non-dualistic or idealistic interpretation. So he's a philosophical exegete. He writes exegesis of the texts, and he's concerned with adapting the extreme tantric cults, if you like, to cleaning them up and making them respectable for the householder, the Brahmanical householder in Kashmir, and also for the king. Now, the philosophical articulation of his work is called the Pratyabhijna, the recognition school. And this is a pure philosophical idealism. Now, within the Trika system, there are two ritual systems that Abhinavagupta describes: the Tantra Prakriya, the system of Tantra, and the Kula Prakriya, the system of the Kula. Now, the Tantra Prakriya are the normative rites that a Shaiva would have to do every day of his life, which involved visualizing the body, visualizing this trident that I spoke of earlier through the body, with the goddesses emanating out from it. So you perform usual Shaiva rites, the purification of the body, and then visualizing yourself as the deity with this trident pervading the body. And you become identified with the deities through the systems that I spoke of last week, of purification of the body, creation of the divine body through imposition of mantras, nyasa, mental visualization, mental worship, and external worship. And you'd worship these deities on a portable mandala that you'd carry around with you, or possibly even on a skull or on a cloth. The Kula Prakriya is the esoteric rite. This is the secret rite, the secret sexual rite that described by Abhinavagupta in chapter 29 of his text, in which he claims that you can achieve enlightenment through this secret sexual rite with the duty, the messenger. And that's probably the clearest expression, the clearest description of those rituals that we have in the Tantra Loka. There's an exposition and a translation of this text, that chapter 29, by a Catholic priest in Australia, whose name I've forgotten now, but it's called the Kula Ritual. So if you're interested in that, check out with this book, The Kula Ritual. But most of the Tantra Loka is an account of the cosmology and an exposition of this text, the Malini Vijayotara. Now, the esoteric ritual is only for the very highly developed yogis, says Abhinavagupta. And in the Tantra Loka, he describes Shaiva Yoga, different systems of Shaiva Yoga, which are originally found in the MVT. And he calls these methods upayas. Wondering how far to go into all this. Okay, just briefly then. A human being, according to the Shaivas, has various faculties. There's the will, there's thinking, and there's the body acting. There's thinking, feeling. Sorry, there's willing, thinking, and acting. I'm getting confused because in the West, the distinction is willing, thinking, and feeling. For Abhinavagupta, it's willing, thinking, and acting. Yeah. So you've got these three faculties that a human being has: will, and that's sometimes identified with desire, icha. Willing, thinking, and acting. So these different ways of paths to enlightenment are developing different faculties, human faculties, developing will, developing thinking, or developing action. Thinking or knowledge or cognition, jnana, and action, kriya. So a human being has these three faculties. So the one of the ways, which I've got written down, called the Shambhava Upaya, develops will. And will is broadly interpreted to mean the instinct as well. It's a very broad term, is it? It has the connotation of what you want, desires, will, in the what we would understand by will, and instinct as well. So it seems to be all incorporated within this term. The semantic range of icha is quite wide. So the upsurge of emotion and the upsurge of emotion and instinct can shatter thought construction, which leads to enlightenment. So the sexual rite, for example, is the upsurge of desire, which can shatter thought construction, the development of icha. Putting yourself in a situation of fear can make icha rise up in you and shatter thought construction. Pain can shatter thought construction. So you put yourself in situations of intentional suffering, really, in order to this upsurge of emotion will shatter thought construction. So that's one of the ways. The second way that Abhinavagupta describes is the development of pure thought, such as I am Shiva, I am omnipotent, I am omnipresent, is a pure thought, which if you keep thinking about it, will purify all the other thoughts, and you'll suddenly realize, you'll wake up to that truth, I am Shiva. And then there's a way of acting, Arnava, which is also called the individual means, the Arnava Upaya, which is mantra, the repetition of mantra, meditation, ritual, and everything else associated with religious practice, really, particularly in the Shaiva Siddhanta. So there's a hierarchy of these. And of course, the ultimate upaya is that which is not an upaya. Thank you. Is the non-upaya, the anupaya, for non-means. And the anupaya is the realization of enlightenment without any method at all. It's a sudden waking up to this reality. So there are really four ways. One of the ways is not a way, the path which is not a path, the method which is not a method. Because all of these methods, Abhinavagupta says, contain the delusion of dualism, the dvaita sammoha. All of those are actually deluded, because the truth is pure consciousness. And if there's any one reality which is pure consciousness, any method to attain it must be illusory, because there can be no distinction between the path and the goal. So that he talks about the sameness of goal. So for Abhinavagupta, there's contradiction really in him. On the one hand, these methods are a graded hierarchy, with the Shambhava at the top and the Arnava at the bottom, and the Anupaya even higher than that. On the other hand, he says that all of these gradations are deluded, because there's only one reality, which is pure consciousness. So there's a passage that I've got written down here from the Tantra Sara, which exemplifies this idea, which is on the second side of the sheet. You've got under the non-means, the Anupaya. This is his description of the Anupaya in the Tantra Sara. He's got, the Supreme Lord is the essence of his own light and our own self. Now, the Supreme Lord is the essence of his own light and us, our own self. By what means then is he to be achieved? How can you achieve something which you already are? Due to his own light, he cannot be known. Due to his eternity, his essence cannot be attained. Due to the non-existence of a covering over consciousness, there cannot be the cessation of a covering, avarana. Due to the absence of a distinct penetration of the Lord, there cannot be any penetration in pravesha. What then is the means? What's the method? How can you achieve this enlightenment? If it's distinct, it cannot be accomplished. Therefore, this totality is of a single reality of consciousness only, undivided by time, unlimited by space, unclouded by constraints, unobstructed by forms, unsignified by word, and unmanifested by means of knowledge. So very uncompromising monism there, non-dualism. One reality of consciousness only. Any distinctions are illusory. And another commentary on theistic language. Whenever there is theistic language in the text, like Ishvara or the goddess, Abhinavagupta accepts it, but he always reinterprets it. He always says, actually, what they're really talking about is consciousness. And he says, with reference to the great goddess, this is not the great goddess, the power, because it is not based on some other reality other than the self. It is not God, the possessor of power, because it is not the basis of anything. It is not the object of meditation due to the non-existence of a meditator, nor is it the meditator due to its being bereft of any object of meditation. It is not the object of worship because there is no worshipper, and it is not the worshipper due to the non-existence of an object of worship. It is not mantra, and nor its object, and not the Lord who is the possessor of mantra. The great Lord is not not initiation, nor the initiator, nor the initiated. So again, an extreme kind of monism being presented there, which is language not dissimilar to some Buddhist language really that you get. So an extremely a radical monism has to speak in these contradictory terms, because it doesn't allow any distinctions to get off the ground, and it's very difficult to maintain. So on the one hand, Abhinavagupta has this kind of language. Yet on the other hand, he very quickly falls into language of purity and impurity and hierarchy. But some of his arguments, the Pratyabhijna is really a philosophical system, which exists before Abhinavagupta. It goes back to about the 8th century, Vasugupta. Vasugupta had a dream in which Shiva said there were these sutras inscribed on a stone on the top of the Mahadeva mountain. And so Vasugupta, when he woke up, climbed up the mountain and found the sutras there and conveyed them to the human community. But the weather's worn them away now, so they're not there anymore.
Vasugupta.
Vasugupta, yeah. Shiva sutras. And he's a kind of first in this kind of tradition, I suppose.
What was his date?
Probably about the 8th century, 8th or 9th century. And there's a whole tradition of a recognition school that comes after him. I won't go in, you can read these details in introductory books or in Sanderson's account. But it ends up with Abhinavagupta. He's and his student Kshemaraja, and they're the last in this tradition, really, the last in this line. There's Yogaraja about 100 years later, and there's the commentator on the Tantra Loka as well, again about 100 years later. But the tradition really dies with them. And Pratyabhijna is idealism in a philosophical sense. That the world is pure consciousness. This is the function. This is the intellectual project, that to establish philosophically that the world is pure consciousness, and that the appearances, the abhasas that comprise the world, are not so much emanations but are that very consciousness. The world is the very consciousness, rather than an appearance, simply an appearance of consciousness. And seeing the world as consciousness is a liberating cognition. If you see the world as consciousness, you get enlightened, get liberated from the illusion of rebirth. And Abhinavagupta says, he wrote a commentary on Upaladeva, who's one of the key thinkers in this tradition, who's Abhinavagupta's grandteacher. In his comments, he says, a distorted perception is corrected by a later correct perception. This is his argument, basically. In the Ishvara Pratyabhijna Vimarshini, the commentary on the Ishvara Pratyabhijna, the verses on the recognition of the Lord. So, okay, a distorted perception is corrected by a later correct perception, as in the case of someone seeing silver, which upon in turn turns out to be mother of pearl. Or as a person who sees two moons due to eye trouble might later correct the perception by seeing a single moon. So the later perception, the corrupted perception, is corrected by a correct perception later on. Now that what he calls the relation of contraries, the Bhadya-Bhadaka Bhava, the relation of contraries, is only possible if there's a self-identical consciousness relating those different perceptions. So, says Abhinavagupta, if the cognition of silver is destroyed by a subsequent cognition that is not silver, then it follows that this could only occur when both the correct and erroneous cognitions rest in the same subject. And that's this subject, he says, is not an individual self, but as a unitary self. So he's a critique of Buddhist views. The Buddhists, he's particularly having a go at Dharma Kirti. You've got, here's the flow of consciousness. And this flow of consciousness, according to the Buddhists, is divided up into these chitta-kshanas, these moments of consciousness which come into existence and go out of existence. But the Buddhists deny there's anything linking them up. So whether there's an internal Buddhist critique of this, that if these are A, B, C, how can A cause B and B cause C? There's a problem of causation. But anyway, one of the claims is that A causes B, causes C, and so on. But there's no essence underlying it all. Now, Abhinavagupta comes along and accepts this idea that you can have a cognition at A, the seeing silver on the ground, and then it's corrected at B by realizing that it's actually mother of pearl. So how can that perception correct that perception if there's no underlying self, he says. And so he was criticizing the Buddhists. There is an underlying self. So he says the determinate cognition of this is only possible because of the relation to other cognitions. So, for example, the perception of the bareness of the ground entails the absence of a pot on the ground. They always use pots and mats because it's the Indian philosopher's table, pots and mats. So the perception of the bareness of the ground entails the absence of a pot on the ground. So a cognition is only possible because of its relation to other cognitions. And because you can understand the relation of one cognition to other cognitions because of the self, because of the underlying notion of a self. Cognition is differential in that one cognition entails the absence of others. So the perception of a pot entails the perception of a piece of ground entails the absence of a pot upon it, or the absence of whatever it is. So error is corrected by the subsequent correct perception. Similarly, two things which have appeared to be distinct and recognized through a determinate cognition to be identical, as in the case of a lotus seen in the blue lamplight but red in the sunlight. So we've had the perception of something, one thing seen as two different things. So two things which have appeared to be distinct are recognized through a cognition of the same thing as the lotus, which appears to be blue in the lamplight but red in the sunlight. And recognition then, as you get recognition in those ordinary cognitions, so you get recognition in the ultimate sense of recognition of the world as consciousness only, which corrects ignorant dualist perception. Is the goal of the system. So as you see the lotus to be red or blue, so you see the world to be pluralistic or monistic or one thing through the shift of cognition. And this cognition could arguably be understood as avidya, as wisdom, in the sense that correct cognition is seeing the world as it really is, namely as consciousness. So this anupaya, this realization of anupaya, the non-means, is an immediate liberation from the cycle of rebirth. And Abhinavagupta also relates this to grace. So how can there be grace in this system? So he uses the language of grace, anugraha, prasada, shakti part, and the descent of energy. So he presents philosophical arguments for a pure monism against the Buddhists and against the dualists. The Shaiva Siddhanta. And he also, at the same time, uses a language of theism to describe this awakening liberation. It's the grace of Shiva, or the descent of power. So the wisdom is that the world is consciousness and is an awakening through grace. So here again we're faced with this paradox that you get throughout Abhinavagupta's work. On the one hand, we have a language of non-dual identity within which the term anupaya can be located. On the other, we have a language of grace which entails a theism and so implicitly a dualism that Abhinavagupta wishes to refute. But nevertheless, this is not theism, it's a kind of atheism really. Ultimately, because anugraha is the spontaneous expression of unlimited consciousness arising from its spontaneous freedom, its svatantra, svatantra or svachanda. So it's not a theistic god bestowing grace upon devotees, although that's one kind of language. In reality, it's the spontaneous expression or manifestation of pure consciousness. Realizing its own freedom. So the liberating force of anugraha is, in truth, not the descent of a power other than the self, but is the immediate opening out of the realization that both subject and object are within the single reality of consciousness. Now, arguably, one of the notable things about Abhinavagupta's argument in the Ishvara Pratibhigna Vimarshini is that it's virtually devoid of any ethical components. He's not interested in ethics. And as this is possibly support Zaina's contention that non-dualistic systems are not interested in ethics and are arguably devoid of ethics in some sense. Shankara wouldn't agree with that, but Abhinavagupta thinks that ethics are purely within the realm of the conventional, and that the ultimate enlightenment is the shattering of any ethical understanding of the world, because he sees that as shankar, as constraint or limitation. So the purpose of enlightenment, one of the consequences of enlightenment is the shattering of shankar, the shattering of brahmanical constraint and ethical understanding of the world. Because pure consciousness is beyond ethics,
so
it's beyond doubt.
Shattering of shankar. Shankar is like doubt.
It also has the implication of
the Hindi word
of
shankar.
Fear. Inhibition, fear.
Okay.
Which Abhinavagupta saw as characteristic of orthodox Brahmanism. So that's ethics for Abhinavagupta is dharma, which is fear. And to be enlightened, you have to go beyond fear and realize the truth of this spontaneous expression of unlimited consciousness. So that's Abhinavagupta's general argument in his last text, the commentary on the Ishvara Pratibhigna, Karika. So there are three phases to his work. The first, he wrote a commentary on the Dvanyalochana, which is a book of aesthetics. He then developed his the Tantra Loka in this middle period of his life, where he's looking at the colonizing the Shaiva Siddhanta, if you like. And then his last book was the Ishvara Pratibhigna Vimarshini, the commentary on the Utpaladeva's verses, in which he defends in a philosophical discourse the non-dual position that he maintains and argues against the Buddhists and against the dualists in a very eloquent way. So after Abhinavagupta, Kshemaraja picks up the reins a bit, and his Pratibhigna Hridaya, the essence of the Pratibhigna, is really an excellent introduction to this whole philosophical discourse. And there's not a good translation, but there's Jaidev Singh's translation of Kshemaraja. Secret of Recognition, Pratibhigna Hridaya, which is published by Motilal. Like Shiva Raja.
Can't get that in the David Nagari surrender.
the heart, the Hridaya, the heart of recognition, the secret of recognition, Pratibhigna. But that's a good introduction to the whole system.
Yeah, it's so difficult to write it in English. I also end up writing in Hindi only all the time.
Yes, that's right.
It's easy for me to write, but there we go.
Well,
then
a couple of the consonant combinations that just fox me there on inspection. The N R D. Is the R a vowel?
Is that a vowel?
R D Y. Yes, is that a vowel?
That's a vowel. Yes,
that's a vowel. That's easy. I can't write it. That's all right.
Just standard transliteration. Perhaps we should have a session on that transliteration. It's easier in Devanagari because instead of English, you've got to write two letters for every one in
some of the consonant combinations in Devanagari.
Always when you teach, I'm writing in Hindi only.
Yes. Yes.
Shruta Devanagari, it's so easy to actually write.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, it's
you write the 49 letters of the alphabet. Some of the consonant combinations, if they're in groups of three, aren't easy.
They're not easy, no.
And if you don't come across them regularly, you think, hang on, what is that? You know, how do I put that down?
Intrusion
into asking about was that a vowel or a consonant?
Yeah,
that
vowel.
Was a vowel, I can write the whole word, but if that had been a consonant, I would have been foxed.
Yes. You get more vowels in Sanskrit than English. It's very odd. So, anyway, have a go at this Pratibhijna Hridaya, if you can. And also, there's a translation by of the Ishvara Pratibhijna Vimarshini. There is a translation in English of that text. And also, Torella, the Ishvara Pratibhijna. Karikas. That's published by Motilal about 5 years ago now. But it's a very good translation, very good text. So that's the verses on which Abhinavagupta comments, but there is also a translation of his commentary. So it's a very rich tradition and well worth exploring. And it goes into the South India, and develops there to some extent, but in Kashmir there's silence really after Kshemaraja, apart from two lights, Yogaraja and the commentator on the Tantraloka.
So Brahmanism was patronized by the Gupta dynasty also in India?
Yeah.
We have no great writers there. Philosophical writers. We have like the Kalidas. We have the Kalidas in the Gupta period.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to philosophy, we have no great writers there?
Not after Abhinavagupta's. Oh, you do in philosophy generally, but this tradition, this Pratibhijna
tradition
stops. Yeah. So any points or questions before we fall back?
Talking about the tantras and Shaivism, where can we find these so-called Dashamahavidyas? Can we find them as...
They tend to be later. They're part of... You know that... The left... Yeah. They're part of this Mahavidyas come in the Kula tradition, the 10 Mahavidyas, part of the Kaula group, if you like, but they develop later on, and you get these left-hand groups tend to get appropriated by Brahmanism, and there's a tradition called the Sri Vidya, which still exists in the South, which is orthodox tantric Brahmanism, which uses the Mahavidyas.
So this is closer to the Brahmanas tradition than
Yeah, this is closer to the Brahmanical tradition because this is respectable. But they do have a secret underside of the left-hand tantric tradition within the Sri Vidya. And they have a secret rite involving the offerings of blood and sex and alcohol. But there's a book by Kinsey on this, on the Mahavidyas, Kinsey, the 10 Mahavidyas, which is good. And there's also a book by Gudrun Buneman, B-U-H-N-E, Buneman. Two volumes. It's a translation of a tantric text which contains material on the 10 Vidyas. Very interesting, because she's got lots of pictures in that book.
Could I just get the surname again?
B-U-H-N-E-M-A-N-N.
Okay.
Okay, so next week we're finishing off, as last week we'll finish off, and we'll look at the Pancharatra. And anything else you want to perhaps do a brief survey of what we've done?